It is Friday, September the 15th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, another missile launch by North Korea, and China detains a Taiwanese man.
I think this has been a case which is creating a lot of difficulty across the Taiwan Straits, and if China really wants to have good relations with Taiwan, it can't just be arresting and confining Taiwan citizens.
Also ahead, dissidents' trial in Turkey, policing social media, and the plight of the U.S. Democratic Party. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. North Korea today fired an unidentified missile from its capital, Pyongyang, that flew over Japan before landing in the northern Pacific Ocean.
我国としてはこのように繰り返される北朝鮮による度を越した挑発行動。Japan's
Chief Cabinet Secretary Yoshihide Suga said the government strongly condemned the excessive provocation. He also said the Japanese government will respond to the situation with the U.S., South Korea, and other related countries, including the U.N. Security Council, and they will monitor the damaged situation in order to protect and ensure people's safety. It was North Korea's second test flight over the territory of the close U.S. ally in less than a month and has followed the sixth and most powerful nuclear test by North Korea, that one to date on September the 3rd. On board the U.S. presidential airplane, President Trump held an impromptu press conference where reporters asked him about the crisis over North Korea's nuclear test. He said he was working closely with Chinese President Xi Jinping on North Korea's provocative actions.
We have a very good relationship with China and with the President of China. We are working on different things. I can't tell you obviously what I'm working on, but believe me, the people of this country will be very, very safe. I think that a lot of effort is being put into this. We're looking at what's going on. I mean, as we speak, we are literally looking at it right now.
Meantime, U.S. Defense Chief Jim Mattis has called the latest launch a reckless act by the North Koreans. He was at the U.S. Strategic Command headquarters in the state of Nebraska at the time of the launch. Asked about a possible American military response, Mattis said he did not want to talk about it just yet. A Taiwan teacher and a rights and democracy activist confessed this week at a trial in China to attempting to subvert the Beijing government. The one-day trial of Li Mingzhe took place after he disappeared soon after arriving on the mainland in March. Authorities later acknowledged that they had taken him into custody on suspicions of damaging national security. Monash University Asian Studies Professor Emeritus Bruce Jacobs tells VOA's Victor Beatty Lee's disappearance and arrests came as a surprise.
He had been to China before. There had been no indication there were any difficulties. And this time he was arrested. You know, he just disappeared. And as you say, the Chinese later acknowledged that they had him. But he's been basically held incommunicado for 6 months. So there's been great concern in Taiwan about his welfare and what's going to happen.
Is he a political pawn in the ongoing tensions between Taiwan and the mainland?
Well, he may be a pawn. When you say the tensions between Taiwan and the mainland, I mean, I think we need to state very clearly that any tensions between Taiwan and the mainland come from the mainland side. They're not created from Taiwan at all. And I think that has to be stated explicitly.
His wife, Li Qingyu, who along with his mother are now in China, said Saturday before she left that his supporters would forgive her husband if he says something in court which disappoints them, as he might be required to give testimony against his own free will.
I think what she was saying was that she asked that his supporters be forgiving if he said things which didn't seem consistent with what he'd said in the past. And the point was that in that court situation, he may not have free will to speak as he might wish to.
Rights groups and the Taiwan government have tried to gain his release. Will they be successful?
Well, that depends on China. It's not clear. I understand that a semi-government organization has hired a lawyer to go with his wife to give her advice, but not to act on behalf of her husband. As we know from past experience, these court-appointed lawyers from China really have limited ability to do any real defense. I think this has been a case which is creating a lot of difficulty across the Taiwan Straits, and if China really wants to have good relations with Taiwan, it can't just be arresting and confining Taiwan citizens. If, in fact, the government in China is not happy with particular people coming to China, it can forbid their entry, but it shouldn't let them in and then arrest them on flimsy charges.
Monash University Asian Studies Professor Bruce Jacobs speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. In the Turkish capital, Ankara, the trial of two educators charged with terrorism has started. The defendants have been on a hunger strike for more than 5 months to protest their firing as part of a government crackdown after last year's failed coup. Dorian Jones reporting now from Istanbul that hunger strike and the trial has become a focal point of government opposition.
The Ankara courthouse, where Semih Ozakçı and Nuriye Gülmen are on trial for terrorism charges, was surrounded by a large security presence. Police outside the court prevented opposition parliamentary deputies from reading a declaration of support for the educators who are accused of supporting a prohibited left-wing group. Republican People's Party deputy Mahmut Tanal slammed the police presence. He said the situation is this. This is a police state, an authoritative fascist system that is at full swing. This fascist system will definitely be destroyed. Video released on the internet appeared to show riot police in the courthouse attacking supporters of Ozakçı and Gülmen. Critics claim the case against the educators is politically motivated after their peaceful campaign against the loss of their jobs as part of an ongoing government crackdown drew national attention. More than 150,000 people have been purged from their posts since last year's failed coup. Lawyers representing the two educators were arrested earlier this week on anti-terror charges. Concerns over the fairness of the trial were further heightened when neither Ozakçı or Gülmen were allowed to attend Thursday's hearing. Security forces said they did not have sufficient staff to take them to court and that they were not healthy enough to attend. Political scientist Cengiz Aktar says the two educators have put the government in a difficult position.
The government, they don't like the idea of their cases becoming a kind of cause célèbre. So therefore, they are trying to do everything to hide them in a way. And they were not taken to the court. I mean, clearly the government is unhappy with this, and they are probably trying their best to keep them alive by all means. And the only clear message is that they are unhappy with it and they don't know what to do with it.
The government has strongly defended the trial, insisting the judiciary is independent and the ongoing crackdown is necessary to protect Turkish democracy. But analysts say the controversy over Gülmen and Ozakçı and growing concerns about their deteriorating health could influence the government's approach to the case. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
On a visit to the U.S. state of Florida, President Trump applauded emergency personnel and the military for their response to Hurricane Irma, which inflicted heavy damage several days ago as it churned through the state.
Well, we love the people of Florida, and they went through something that I guess the likes of which we can really say nobody's ever seen before. They've never seen a category like this coming because it came in really at a five. All you have to do is look at what happened in the Keys. But we love these people, and we're going to be back, and we're going to help. And the job that everybody has done in terms of first responder and everybody has been incredible.
There have been at least 25 storm-related deaths in Florida, and recovery efforts are underway. But officials have cautioned that it will take a long time to repair the damage left by the hurricane that also devastated several Caribbean islands. Meantime, Hurricane Max has slammed into Mexico's southern Pacific coast. It dumped rain on an area east of the resort city of Acapulco before weakening into a tropical storm as it moved inland into Guerrero State. Last fall, the U.S. held national elections, and many of the voter surveys indicated the Democratic Party candidate for president, Hillary Clinton, would win by a significant margin over the Republican candidate, Donald Trump. On election night, as those votes were counted, it turned out that Donald Trump had won. Exit polls indicated numerous voters from both major political parties had said they wanted a change, something Mr. Trump was promising, saying he would reduce the size of government and provide jobs to those in need. In just a few months, the U.S. will hold what are called midterm elections, in which all the members of the House of Representatives will be campaigning, along with many senators and leaders in the states across the nation. VOA's Carol Castiel sought some insight on the plight of the Democratic Party from Jim Kessler. He is Senior Vice President for Policy at Third Way, a centrist think tank.
Well, Jim, let's talk about the Democratic Party. What is the status of the Democratic Party today?
Okay, well, the Republican Party is in horrible shape, but the Democratic Party in some ways is in worse shape. You know, if you look at it electorally, Democrats resemble now a regional party. We do very well along the wealthy Acela corridor, that's the northeast from Washington, D.C. up to Massachusetts. We do very well on the Pacific coast, but then there's 40 states in between. And in those states, we're doing very, very poorly. So Democrats are doing well in wealthy, sophisticated, urbane, highly educated areas. That's not most of this country.
And what you're saying is something that many analysts have concluded and others, that Democrats seem to be out of touch with ordinary people, the people the Democrats have traditionally championed, the small business owner, the workers, the poor, minorities. So how is it that Democrats have become so out of touch?
The phenomenon that's gone on is really for the first time in a very long time, Democrats lost a lot of voters who were in economic need. And usually the party did very well among those types of voters. They did poorly among voters that were wealthy. That's kind of flipped around. We're now a coalition of essentially wealthy, educated people and minority groups. So the party has lost touch in recent times. I think the party took a wrong direction when its big focus became things like income inequality. Not that income inequality isn't a big problem in this country. It is. But it's just not a top-of-mind concern if you live in most of the country where your concerns are really, you know, jobs, getting a raise, having economic security in your life. Income inequality seems like an academic discussion when you're having real life problems.
So the question then is, what do the Democrats need to do to expand their support around the country? How do they win back Trump supporters who previously may have voted even Democratic, especially white working class, non-college educated voters?
This was Trump's strength. He won those voters by enormous margins, carried states that had been Democratic states for decades to win the election. I think a couple of things. One is Democrats need to take a broad path, not a narrow path to victory. So they need to appeal to more voters, not just let's try and get our base more excited and go further left. And if we can get our base more excited, maybe more of them will turn out to vote and we'll win in some of these areas. I think that's not going to work. Second is just, you know, they need to become the jobs party again. They need to be about more jobs, not just making jobs more fair. They need to have an answer to technology and automation that, you know, show that people have a life and that they're going to have an opportunity to earn a good life. I think we need to kind of get back to basics about having, you know, people be able to survive and do well in this new economy.
So Democrats can't simply oppose Trump, right, and expect to win.
Yeah. Well, that's the easy thing to do is oppose Trump, and it's a target-rich environment. There's something that happens every single day, and no one's immune to it. It's possible that opposing Trump will be enough. It's possible. He could be so unpopular. But look, that's what Hillary Clinton basically did. It did not work. That's what Democrats did all across the board in Senate and House races. It didn't work there either. People don't like Trump. They don't like Democrats either. They're looking for an alternative. You know, if you look at this last primary election for president, Donald Trump was essentially an independent candidate who took over the Republican Party. Bernie Sanders was an independent candidate who nearly took over the Democratic Party. People were looking for something very different because they didn't like either party. So opposing Trump, I don't think it's going to be enough.
Let's talk about your trip to the rural areas in this country, Jim. You recently toured the area to get your finger on the pulse of what people are thinking, whether they were Trump voters or Bernie Sanders voters. What were the most salient findings that you discovered?
So this was something that we did as an organization. November happened, Trump won. We were surprised, as anybody, and we thought, you know, we just have to rethink what we're doing. And so normally, like, we're a think tank, but we also do polling. We would hire pollsters. We would do a 2,000-person poll. We'd spend a lot of money, et cetera. This time we said, you know what? We need to go out there ourselves. We can't confuse listening with a poll. Listening is actually talking to people. And I went to Western Illinois in an area called the Quad Cities, and it was fascinating. I, you know, just learned so much from being there.
What did you learn, for example, specifically? What were they telling you, these voters?
So let me tell you the things that I found most profound, because there were a couple of things. The first thing was, when I was out in Western Illinois, the first question we asked every person, whether they were Trump supporters or Hillary or Bernie supporters, was, tell me what it's like to live here. And their answer was always the same. They loved where they lived. And I spent a week there. I don't blame them. After a week, I loved where they lived too. It's beautiful. There's some rural. There's some small towns. There's things to do. It's a wonderful place. The next question we asked was always the same too. For an 11th grader today, what will it be like for him or her 10 years from now? And their answers were all the same, which is, there's no future here. You know, there's not jobs, there's not opportunity. And then when we would say, okay, well, suppose that 17-year-old is a success, what happened? What made that person a success? And they said, the person left. So here you had people who loved where they lived, had roots there, and felt, there's no future in my town. And that was, economically, I thought that was very, very profound, and something that you don't really hear on the East Coast and the West Coast. People feel like, wow, there's a lot of opportunity here. So that was really one of the things that struck us.
Kessler also spoke about the Democratic Party's plan to rejuvenate itself. It's called A Better Way, and it's focused on better jobs and better pay. But Kessler says there needs to be more than that. He says Democrats need to listen to the people to find out what they're thinking and doing. Jim Kessler is Senior Vice President for Policy at the Third Way, a centrist think tank. He was speaking with Carol Castiel, who is host of the VOA program Press Conference USA. You can hear more of their conversation by going to our website, voanews.com, and searching for Press Conference USA under the Listen tab. And now it's time to find out what's trending on social media with Andrew Palchewski.
As long as there have been social networks, there have been government efforts to police them. And today we look at two instances where the U.S. government is getting involved in social media. The first is actually a story we've talked about all this week, an announcement by Facebook that Russian-affiliated groups spent about $100,000 on Facebook ads leading up to the U.S. presidential election in 2016. That story only grew this week when we found out this wasn't just limited to ads. It included Facebook events, including an event for an anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim rally that was supposed to be held just months before the election. Well, all of this talk has caught the attention of one man in particular, Robert Mueller. Robert Mueller is the former director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and he's currently the special counsel that's looking into Russia's misinformation efforts during the 2016 presidential election. According to reports this week, Mueller is increasingly focused on social media. He says that could be the key to looking at Russia's misinformation and how they got their information into the United States. So there's going to be a lot more attention put on Facebook and Twitter. In fact, Mueller's already asked Facebook and Twitter for data about how this misinformation spread, how it got onto these social networks, and what damage it might have caused. And another story we've been reporting on over the past few weeks and months, the Trump administration's effort to monitor social media for people looking to immigrate to the United States. Officials from U.S. Customs and Border Protection and U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement said this week that social media monitoring should be part of the visa-seeking process. But they added that the monitoring should not stop once a person gets a visa or once they come to the United States. In fact, they also proposed that monitoring should continue as long as a person is in the United States to check what they're doing and make sure they don't have any links to terrorism or other organizations that could do harm. It remains to be seen whether or not this program will actually go forward, and if it does, how extensive it will be. But based on the comments this week, I expect government involvement in social media is going to grow in the weeks, months, and even years to come.
That is International Edition's Andrew Palchevsky, and many thanks to you, Andrew. You can find him on Twitter at APAL. I'm there as well at VOA Norman, and our program, International Edition, can be found at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
It's called RoboChef, a restaurant in Tehran where customers order pizza on touchscreen tables. Customer Andreas Ripstein and his wife can also enjoy playing games on the interactive touchscreen while they wait for their order.
Just to make your own pizza here, choose the different ingredients and so on. A new experience.
Once ordered, the pizza or the drinks are delivered to you not by a waiter, but by a conveyor belt. Computer engineer Hossein Zaibadel is the restaurant's co-founder and manager. He also designed the ordering system software and the automated serving belt. He says, we didn't want robotic automation to be limited to factories and high-tech firms. We wanted to bring it to the community so that people can use it better. Customers seem to like it. The restaurant is busy, and in some ways, Zaibadel says, the service is faster, and it's a different environment and less boring. For Andreas and his wife, that seems to be the case for now. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
Says VOA's International Edition, Somali-American model Iman was one of the most sought-after fashion models of the 1970s and 80s. Now, another Somali-American model is making headlines as the first hijab-wearing woman to walk the runways in New York and Italy. VOA's Faith Lapidus introduces us to Halima Aden.
Among the young women in last year's Miss Minnesota USA pageant was Halima Aden, who competed in a hijab and a burkini.
I wear the hijab every day, you know, so it's like if I'm going to try something new, I'm going to take that part with me, and it was just a no-brainer.
The Somali-American teen was not crowned Miss Minnesota, but she did win a contract with a major modeling agency, the first hijab-wearing model to sign with a top agency. The world of high fashion is a far cry from the Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya, where Aden was born. Before her family left for the United States, she had a diverse group of playmates.
Different people, different refugees from all over Africa came together in Kakuma, yet we still found common ground. The kids, like, we played, all of us, and, you know, we celebrated each other's holidays, if that makes sense. There's not that many opportunities in Kakuma, so when it was Christmas, best believe we're all going to celebrate. And when it's Eid, we all celebrated that too.
She says that's not always the case in the United States. But the hijab is becoming a more familiar sight in American fashion. Nike will launch a breathable mesh hijab next year, and American Eagle Outfitters created a denim hijab with Aden as its main model. Aden was featured on the June cover of Vogue magazine. And in July, she graced the cover of the beauty magazine Allure.
She truly is just like a normal teenage girl, a normal American teenage girl. So I think that for us, again, like our mission being we want to redefine what beauty standards are. I think she's someone who's so amazingly representative of who we are as America, as a melting pot. It just totally made sense for us.
As Aden enjoys her current success, she remains grateful for the UN efforts in Kakuma. She hopes to return to the camp one day to work with refugee children to show them they also have the potential to become international stars. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News, Washington.
Country singer Troy Gentry of the popular duo Montgomery Gentry was memorialized late Thursday by friends at the Grand Ole Opry. Singers there, they described him as funny and kind, an artist with a huge appetite for life, that he loved his family, his music, his band, and his fans. The 50-year-old Gentry died Friday in a helicopter crash. The pilot, who was killed also, reportedly said just after takeoff that the aircraft was having mechanical problems. On Thursday night, Little Big Town, Vince Gill, Charlie Daniels, Trace Atkins were among the stars who gathered for the service. They sang songs like How Great Thou Art, Wayfaring Stranger, and My Old Kentucky Home. Gentry's casket was placed in the famous circle in the middle of the Opry stage, where he often stood to sing with his duo partner, Eddie Montgomery. One of Gentry's best-known songs is While You're Still Young.
Blowing out spring break with your not right friends. Wake up on the beach with new ink on your skin. Do something crazy and dumb while you're still young. Go on and tie the knot, start a new life. Take turns getting up when the baby cries.
Troy Gentry is survived by his wife, Angie Gentry, as well as their daughters, Taylor and Kaylee. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Latest world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay with us. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zainab Abdul-Rahman, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday. Now a bit more of Troy Gentry as we pay tribute.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States joins the United Nations Security Council in strongly condemning what the Security Council called in a statement the heinous and cowardly terrorist attack that took place on September 11, 2017, on an Egyptian security convoy near Al-Arish in northern Sinai. ISIS claimed responsibility for the attack that left at least 18 policemen dead and others injured. Roadside bombs were reportedly used to destroy several military vehicles in the convoy. It was the deadliest attack on Egyptian security forces in months. Those forces have been waging battle against Islamic State terrorists for years, resulting in the deaths of both police and military. In a statement, members of the Security Council affirmed that terrorism in all its forms and manifestations constitutes one of the most serious threats to international peace and security. They underlined the need to bring perpetrators, organizers, financiers, and sponsors of these reprehensible acts of terrorism to justice and urged all states, in accordance with their obligations under international law and relevant Security Council resolutions, to cooperate actively with the government of Egypt and all other relevant authorities in this regard. In addition, the Security Council reiterated that any acts of terrorism are criminal and unjustifiable, regardless of their motivation, wherever, whenever, and by whosoever committed. In a separate statement on the attack in Egypt, State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert expressed the United States' profound condolences to the families and friends of the victims, and our wishes for a speedy recovery for those hurt in the attack. Spokesperson Nauert said, "We will continue to stand with Egypt as it confronts the threat from terrorism."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.